This is Legs McNeil, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra.
Radio Theater, 3 p.m. Thursdays on WGXC Creative Community Radio.
Radio Theater Program. Tonight on Radio Theater, Orson Welles goes camping naked with a bearskin rug. And Amos and Andy and Raggedy Ann and Andy get together and they have Amos and Raggedy Ann and Andy show. That'll be fun. Also, tiny children saying things they can't quite pronounce. That is a really good part of the show. Radio Theater.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WJXC, and that was Yehuda Hanani playing the first movement of J.S. Bach's Suite No. 3 in C major for cello solo. Hanani produces a series of concerts in Great Barrington and Lenox called Close Encounters with Music, and if you love music and history and intellectual brilliance, they're not to be missed. I'll play more of the suite during the program today. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and I am here with Yehuda Hanani. Well, here we are in Spencertown. How long have you lived in this area?
Oh, my goodness. We built this house close to 30 years ago.
And what first drew you to this area?
We fell in love with the entire area, the Hudson Valley, and of course close enough to Massachusetts. And I used to travel all the time. The airport is close enough, but basically it was just falling in love with the area.
And then you found this beautiful spot.
We found the spot. We had a house in Chatham first. We tried it out. Coming from New York, which is New York is like a cult. No, you have to be deprogrammed to leave the city because people who live in New York think that there's no other place on earth that is worth living on. For us, it was a revelation. I mean, the quality of time was different. The relationship with people was different. Just a wonderful small town. Coming back from the big cities or South America or Korea and being surrounded by trees and water, as you said before, It's so refreshing.
Indeed. Now, where were you born?
I was born in Jerusalem, in Israel. I was brought over long ago by Bernstein. A good part of my life, way over half of my life.
Yeah. And you went to school in New York?
I went to school in Juilliard. Right? Isaac Stern was in my charge. If I would skip a class in order to practice more, he would call and say, "What is this? I'm here. You're skipping classes." I had wonderful mentors.
And had you taken up the cello at a much earlier age?
Yes. I started playing the cello when I was about 8. And before that, I had played the violin.
Is there a lot of classical music in Israel?
Yes, there's a lot. We had a recent immigration from Russia. People would get off the plane with the violin cases. And the joke was, those who do not get off the plane with the violin cases are the pianists. Yeah, so there's a lot of interest in music, in the arts in general. Well, I'm interested in not just music, but how the different disciplines relate to one another. Painting, literature, architecture, because these are all different expressions of the same concepts. Structure, discipline, organization of material, reflecting human either emotions or intellect and also reflecting the historic periods. You know, you look at the building, you know when it was built. You listen to a piece of music, you know when it was written. You look at the painting, you know this is Baroque, this is Rococo, this is ancient Greece. So there's a lot of counter relationships and they influence one another. So a lot of composers wrote under the influence sounds like drugs, but being influenced by famous poems or landscapes. So I find it fascinating to connect all the subterranean tunnels that connect all the disciplines. And this is what our series, Close Encounters, is all about. So we choose a theme. And then the theme is not necessarily a musical theme. And we weave a program around it. I've been doing it for many years.
And, of course, when you deliver those talks, it seems right. Like the easiest thing in the world, but I suppose it does take some
It takes a lot of research, but, you know, this is really my world. I live in this bubble more than I live in real life, so I'm embarrassed to my wife's chagrin sometime. You know, it happened to me that I was reading a great book, and I was supposed to connect planes. And I was so much into the book that they made the announcement, and the plane took off without me. I think it's a kind of discipline that you acquire when you are a performer, because you have to get into the moment and into what you're doing. If you play a piece of music, you're in this space inside the work, and it doesn't matter if there is a blackout, if the electricity stops or something. You're in it. You keep going. Do you remember there was a big blackout in New York? I was still a student. The whole city was in the dark. And I was just practicing in my apartment. And all of a sudden, the lights went out. And there was this eerie quiet because, you know, TVs, radios, everything was quiet. And I just took a candle, I put it on, and I continued where I stopped. I just went on. And a neighbor came home and was banging on my door. And she said, "The world will be falling apart and you will still be practicing." And this was really it. I mean, you get into it so deeply that this is your existence at the moment. I try to share this with students too, because it's almost a requirement. You have to lose your sense of proportion. What you do has to become so totally involving that it makes no room. There's no room for anything else. My students who are concerned about being nervous on stage, I tell them, you have to reach this point where you're so deeply into the music that there's no room for being nervous. There's just no space for it.
Are you also learning a lot of new music for these pieces?
I'm learning a lot of new music, old music that I have not played yet, and as well as commissioning new composers to write new works for us for the Close Encounters series. So we have a special project, commissioning project. And every year there's one or two, or sometimes more, pieces are born. And some of them have become very, very popular and mainstay of the chamber music repertoire. Last year was a very special year because it was the year, the 100th anniversary of the suffragette movement, where women got their voting rights in New York State. And we commissioned four women composers. And we, since the quintessential art of women is quilting, because they're too busy to do anything else, they always take pieces and put them together when they have a moment, at least historically. So we created a quilt of 3 or 4 minute squares by different women composers, some very famous, and we presented it just last year. We try to relate music to history, to the location, to the Berkshires, to upstate New York, to the Hudson School of Painters. Rather than isolate it or segregate it in a concert halls, we really try to make it part of who we are and life around us here.
And do you also base your programming somewhat on musicians you've met and want to work with?
Usually the musicians are at the service of the theme or the topic or the... I don't like to think of us as the center of attention. It's composers, yes. Performers, no. Every now and then you go to a concert, and especially if it's a popular name, and you see so-and-so is playing in large print and playing Beethoven, and Beethoven is in tiny print because the performer has become more important. People are going to hear so-and-so playing rather than... It's a great piece of music. So it's nice to try to reverse that. And we are all at the service of great music. Of course, there's ego involved, but you have to keep it in check.
And then once you find something like this, say the Smetana piano trio you played recently.
Yes.
Then you find musicians who know the music.
I either find musicians who know the music or musicians who are interested in learning the piece. By now, the musicians who come to Close Encounters are so seasoned and so experienced that a lot of the standard repertoire is familiar to them. So we just discuss what... And it always has to fit the theme. So normally you go to a concert and you hear an evening of string quartets or an evening of whatever else, piano recital. And here, the theme is what really dominates. Around the theme, I group the pieces. So in one night, you can have a guitarist, a vocalist, a string quartet. It all fits together. So the audience walks people walk out, go home, and they have a new idea about the concept of a topic. And as I said, the topic does not necessarily have to be musical. It could be anything. Yesterday, we celebrated Rossini's anniversary. It was a night of hilarity and a lot of jokes and a lot of... But at the same time, we discovered things about him that people didn't know in the audience. You know, he finished all his operas before he was 40. He wrote all the great operas, and then he somehow lost his touch with the zeitgeist. You know, things were changing. He had a wonderful sense of public taste, what people really wanted for a while, and he was the most celebrated composer in Europe, most influential, the highest paid. And then when 1850-some, there was the premiere of Wilhelm Tell opera, and he was not 40 yet, and he decided that he was no longer with it. And he quit, he stopped, left Paris, went to Italy. And this was the era of Brahms, and Wagner took over, of course, big time. And for 20-some years, he did not write a note. And he had mental problems and physical problems. He was really a wreck. 25 years later, his wife was desperate because he was really deteriorating. She took him back to Paris for medical advice. And like miraculously, whether it was the magic of the city, you know, Paris, or reuniting with some old colleagues and friends, or maybe he got better medical attention when he returned to Paris, but his sense of humor returned, and his appetite. He always loved food, you know, he was a great foodie. And his urge to compose came back. But the period was already, it was a different era. You know, it was the ethos of Wagner. Wagner was riding high, and he had nothing. He would have nothing to do with it. He actually said about Wagner. He said the Wagner's music has very few meatballs and a lot of sauce. This was his idea of what Wagner was all about, and you can see where he comes from with this idea, because you know, he was a gourmet cook, so. But every Saturday in his apartment in Paris, there was a salon, and it was the most coveted social prize to be invited to these soirees. And he played with a select group of pianists. He would play his music, the music that he composed. And this took place for 10 years, the last decade of his life, every Saturday. And he would serve some Italian delicacies first, of course, being a gourmet cook. And then as soon as this was over, his second wife, who had been, by the way, Balzac's mistress, would collect the music. It was all in manuscript. And lock it up in the cabinet in the bedroom, mahogany cabinet. And this was it. So no one could study it. No one could take it home. No one could print it. And this is one of the reasons these pieces, he called them sins of old age, the chefs d'oeuvre in French. Only recently, in recent years, this music came out of some foundation, some Rossini foundation in Italy. But it's an incredible thing. You know, a man who had an amazing career, international fame, who disappeared from the scene, so much so that there were rumors circulated about his death. And his wife had to publish denials in the press. He's still alive. And then all of a sudden, towards the end of his life, he comes back and he writes this wonderful music, Sins of Old Age, and very few people were allowed to play it. Young Saint-Saëns was one of the few who was allowed to perform this music. So anyway, we celebrated all this last night. And it was like rediscovering the man, because everybody knows his operas, but no one knows this late flowering, late life. So this is what I like about music. It has the human content. It has adventurous feeling. It has humor. It has everything. You get into it, and it orders your life. So, you know, here we are, and we're living in such a tumultuous time. Everything is a mess, politically and economically. And you get into this world, and it gives you a chance to have a sense of order, an organization, emotional security. So music is way beyond notes. It's not just the notes. That's another thing. When the government decided to take off music off the public school curriculum, they didn't realize what damage they were doing. It was not just music. It's giving people a sense that it's possible to have order in life, to have discipline, to have beauty, to relate to one another through music. All these things disappear when you don't have music in schools.
Yeah, I always think that one learns a lot by going to church and singing in harmony.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the ancient Greeks believed that the entire universe, the cosmos, was ruled by harmonic relationships. So there were spheres, and the spheres, you know, the expression music of the spheres? This is where it comes from. They believed that actually there was a harmonic relationship between the spheres, and everything was moving and related to one another. And so when you write, Bach still believed it. So when you write music, you are connecting to some cosmic, mystical, religious order, and some divine bliss connected with music. You know, the word muse, of course, comes from music. It's the same root.
This is Richard Roth, and I am here with Yehuda Anani. Here's the second movement from the Bach Suite number 3, the Allemande. Thank you. advance do you plan your programs?
We are now planning a year ahead, because some of the artists are very famous and they are booked ahead. So it's nice to have everything in place, good year in advance.
And you're doing half a dozen concerts?
We do 7 concerts here in the Berkshires, the Close Encounters.
And then you had a festival in Hunter.
We have a festival in Hunter, and we moved it to the Berkshires. We are now at the Berkshire School on Route 41 in Sheffield. Between Great Barrington and Sheffield is a beautiful campus. They invited us this summer, and it was beautiful. We are going to return next summer in August. And we have 50 international students. They come from every corner of the world, really. Korea, Japan, South America, Europe, Australia, there's a girl from Switzerland, Mexico. They come from all over. And, you know, you see these young people coming who, many of whom do not speak English. And they sit together and they make music, and it makes you feel, yes, there is hope. We can still do it. So it's wonderful. We have a great faculty, and it's open to the community. We have master classes and lectures.
And how long does that go?
10 days. We are planning that already too. We just finished, and we are already planning next August.
And do you also still teach in the conservatory?
I teach in Cincinnati. So between concerts, I stop there.
And what kind of a situation is that when you're teaching? Is it one-on-one?
It's one-on-one, and then every week we meet for about 2 hours, and they all play for one another, and they test their nerves and see what happens. There's something happens when you play alone in your practice room, and then all of a sudden you're in the spotlight. And if it's an intimate piece, and you have to create the intimacy as if you are alone in the practice room. And this is true for actors. How do you deal with it? How do you come to the point where you are? Some people are naturally, Yitzhak Perlman walks on the stage as if he's walking to his kitchen to make a cup of tea for himself. I mean, it's just, he is so natural on the stage. Some people who become someone else, they lose their easy personality and they, we need that too. So they have a one-on-one lesson, and then they get together and try out things and see. And then we critique one another.
It seems as though musicians do live in a very focused and intense kind of way.
Yeah, the negative side, the downside of it is that musicians can be very narrow-minded. And this is something that I'm trying to combat with my students. So actually, you may Google on, they just put it on YouTube. I gave a talk about the connection and the relationship between the Impressionist painters and Impressionist composers. I called it the French Revolution, because these people revolutionized both painting and music writing. Debussy, Ravel, Gauguin, Manet. The two Claudes, Claude Debussy and Claude Monet, are the focus of this talk. And it's this kind of thing that I'm trying to instill in my students. Open up your, broaden your horizon, open up, see what, how, because these people inspired one another. We should do the same thing.
Are there composers you'd say you're particularly fond of?
This is a question that is always asked, and my answer is always the piece I'm playing at the moment.
Yes.
Is the piece that I'm most fond of, because you get into it, and for the moment this is your world. Other than that, I would say that Johann Sebastian Bach is really it's like a beacon. I mean, it's just like a beam of light that I have students who, after years, they come to me. There's one woman. She had a troubled life, personal life, and love life. Things did not go well. She said in the darkest moment, she would take a Bach unaccompanied suite and play it. And everything was okay again. People don't realize the power of music, the psychic power, the healing power it has. So, Schumann was losing his mind. Robert Schumann. ended up in an insane asylum the last 2.5 years of his life. And towards the end, he studies Bach. He thought he was sort of reaching out to Bach as if trying to hang on to something that will give him stability and solidity and sense of well-being. And there's something about the music of Bach that is so incredible. It's hard to find words to describe it. It has everything in it. Sort of a marriage of spontaneity and discipline, and passion and organization. All the opposites are united in him. And you get into his world, and with or without the religious overtones, it conveys a certain solid outlook on life. So I would say, if you really pushed me to the wall, to a corner, and said, "Okay, but who is really your favorite composer?" I would have to say.
Yeah. Well, I can understand that. I love the motets. I love the cello. I don't have any cello suites.
You're a vocalist, you sing?
No. I was brought up among Lutherans, so he was
so
kind
Bach
of
is
a house composer.
Of course, how fortunate. Yes. He was only about 2 generations after Luther. And he went to the same church. Bach worshipped the same church and sang in the same choir that Luther sang in. The connection is so strong there. So he felt a tremendous affinity, and he took Lutheran hymns and turned them into chorales. So he uses the material that was originally Luther's liturgy.
When you're practicing here, do you work alone, or do you have sometimes someone on the piano as well?
Every now and then a pianist joins me, but when I'm here, mostly it's by myself. It's good to have a pianist, because the piano, especially if you play a sonata or a piece that was written for the 2 instruments, there's only this much you can do on your own. It's like clapping with one hand. You study the cello, yes, but what's going on? How are you relating it to the rest of the score?
And now, when you're doing a piece, say with 2 other musicians, are you also sort of acting as the conductor?
Never. No. It's a perfect democracy in action. So we get together. Most of the time, you have to know in advance who you invite. So if you work with like-minded people, there will be no friction. Most of the time, there is agreement on tempo, on interpretation. And sometimes, if there isn't, then you try to convince, or someone else has to convince you. But it's beautiful to be open to other possibilities, especially if you play a piece again, a piece that you've been playing many times, and colleagues change, and different pianists comes. And you have a chance to re-experience the piece. So what's the point of sticking stubbornly to something that you think is your idea? It's so much better to just be open and say, okay, let's see what he has to say about this, or she. So it's a chance for recreating or reinventing a certain piece of music. It's all about openness and receptibility.
You say you travel a lot.
Yeah.
And that's international travel as well.
International as well as national. Usually the cello sits next to me, so no one chews my ears. I can take books and correspondence, and you can run a piece of music in your mind. Have you ever tried that?
Well, I think I probably have.
I'm sure. I mean, you can try with a simple song and see if you can actually hear it. There was a famous musician in England. His name was Tovey. He was a child, and he thought that everybody had this gift of not visualizing, but acoustilizing, what shall we call it? Hearing without actually any sound, just hearing inwardly. And he would go through a Beethoven symphony, and then he would clap his hands because the symphony was over, and he was so excited. So I find it very easy on the airplane because, you know, there is this white noise of the engine. The engine of the airplane creates these tremendous sounds that are actually a combination of thousands of sounds. So you can pick and choose from these sounds and kind of create any piece of music you want. And then there is the phenomenon of the worm.
The worm,
a silly
right.
tune gets in there and doesn't want to go out. That happens too.
Have you ever been a composer?
I like to improvise, and I do my own cadenzas.
The cadenzas, I remember.
And when you play Bach, especially after you really, really know the material very well, you are on first name basis with Johann Sebastian, then you can start allowing yourself to actually ornament. If you understand where he comes from and you learn his ideas of ornaments and the right placement for them, and that becomes very nice because, you know, the dances have repetitions. You repeat first half, you repeat the second half. So the word repetition does not apply anymore if you improvise an ornament. So I very much encourage my students to be courageous. And if they do it wrongly, I point it out. But I want them to have this daring of, you know, you don't put the composer on a pedestal. Now, Victor Borge used to say, Mozart has no arms. And he goes only until here, and he would point to his waist. And he said, you call this a bust? you know, these were living people. You have to try to make the music come to life. And a chance not to repeat is always welcome. Gertrude Stein used to say, in music, you don't repeat, you insist. And that's very, very wise. So that's one way of not repeating yourself. Nothing else in life repeats. You can go to the same restaurant a second time, order the same dish, it will not taste the same. You know, there is a line in Shakespeare, King Lear, when the old king is in prison with Cordelia and she's dead. I'm sure you know the play so well. And he's holding her in his arms and he realizes the tragedy of this whole situation, how foolish he was. And he said, thou'lt come no more. Never. 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 Five times. Shakespeare writes the word five times. I would buy a ticket and go see the play just for this moment to see how a great actor would repeat, or not repeat, rather, not repeat the word never five times, and each time view it with different content. The regret, the anger, the frustration, the sense of failure, the sense of tragedy, whatever, just not to just repeat yourself. And we have this in music all the time. The composer will repeat a statement, maybe we call it a sequence in music, when the same phrase repeats, starting on a different note. And the challenge of not just sounding like a Xerox copy, spewing out the same thing again and again and again. It can be in tune, it can be pretty, but if it's the same, you lost the audience. My last teacher was Casals, and I remember in Marlborough he would sit on the bench. He was a very old man already. He was trying to convey this idea that you don't want to say the same thing again and again. And he would choose a word, so you know, with his thick Spanish accent, he would say, great, great, great. He would go on and on repeating this word, just trying to give us the idea that you don't repeat yourself.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and my guest is the cellist Yehuda Hanani. Here is his recording of the third movement of the Bach Suite No. 3 for unaccompanied cello. A courant. Thank you.
This cello, it's a there was a German maker, luthier, by the name of David Teckler. And he was the most famous Roman in Rome maker. He was employed by the Vatican. This cello was commissioned by the Pope in 1730. So it's almost, we're about to celebrate his 300th birthday. And it is a work of art also visually. It's not only the voice, but it's also amazing to behold. It's just gorgeous proportions of the varnish. And everything about it is just so exquisite. And many luthiers have asked me to let them borrow it so they could take the measurements and the proportions so they can make instruments in conforming to this particular shape. The subtle differences.
How did you come into it?
Well, when I was ready, for many years I had an instrument that was loaned to me by the foundation, the America-Israel Cultural Foundation. This was the foundation that brought me over here. And when I was ready to have my own, it was known that, you know, when you reach this caliber of instruments, they're all catalogued, they're all known, so dealers know about it. There was one particular dealer in Chicago who had been my student. He was a very gifted cellist, but he was probably even smarter businessman. So he decided, he and his partner took a map of the United States, and they said, now let's look and see, where is there a big famous orchestra and no violin shop? Ah, Chicago. Okay. So they started the business in Chicago, very smartly. First business deal he did was sell his own cello and his own bow. He had a very good bow. And then they became international famous, very successful internationally. They would sell, they supply whole orchestras in China and really on a very large, very impressive scale. And he made it his point of being the one to find the cello for me. So every few months I would get a call, oh, we have this particular cello. And I said, well, on this weekend I'm playing a concert in Los Angeles. And they would fly a salesman to Los Angeles, meet me backstage, and I would try the cello. And I'm sorry, but it's not what I'm looking for. It's not. And they would always ask, what reservations do you have? What do you dislike about this particular instrument? And they would write notes. And slowly they created, what do they call it in the police? A composite sketch. You know, after all the rejections, they had an idea what I was looking for. And one day I was in Aspen Music Festival in Colorado, and they called from the shop, and he said, Bob, my ex-student, said, this time we have it. I know we have it. And we drove back home, stopped in Chicago on the way from Denver, and I still remember I walked into the room. The cello was leaning against the wall outside of the case. And I fell in love with it before I played it. It was like falling in love with a woman in the room. I saw this cello. I said, oh. And then, of course, I played it. And first thing, I didn't even know yet how I was financing it. First thing I did, I took it out of the shop. I didn't want anyone else to lay eyes on it or be tempted to. Nobody was going to come near it anymore. Took it out, and only then we started worrying about how to purchase it. And it's been, what, 30-some years already. And we traveled around the world a few times over. It's been a wonderful companion. At a certain point, you know, these cellos, it's not that you tell the cello what you want. The cello begins to tell you. You know something? You're asking me something I cannot really do. The cello tells you, or it's you know, let's try. There is a certain relationship with such an instrument. You know the limits. And today I'm not feeling so well, he says. He's 300 years old. You know, I said, this humidity is getting to me. I'm a little, my voice is fuzzy. Please excuse me.
I was talking to your violinist for the piano trios about his Zygmuntowicz.
Oh, yes.
And his experience with the Stradivarius.
Right.
Which was kind of similar. He'd say he could put his finger up in the air and know whether the violin was going to behave in this way or that.
Right. Suvin Kim.
Right.
Yeah. It's a powerful contemporary. Usually the contemporary instruments have more power, more projection. Because that's the more appealing these days is the punch and the projection. Concert halls are very large. These instruments were made palace music for small rooms. So it's rare to find among them an instrument that also has the projection of a modern instrument. When you have the combination of Italian quality and contemporary projection, you're talking about an instrument that can cost well over $10 million.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's insane.
And it's something about some particular inner quality that the instrument has that makes it have that force.
Yes. It's a bit like wines, you know. Every student instrument will give you the same pitch, and yet there are all these little, you know, this one is a little more smoky. You know how wine connoisseurs talk about a taste of a bottle? You know, this one has a certain, they use all sorts of sensual adjectives describing it. That's how instrumentalists talk about it, the instrument.
When is your next concert?
Tomorrow I have to go to Cincinnati again to see my students. There's always something cooking.
And you always have your cello with you?
Not always. It's just economically, because this cello cannot go into the luggage. So if I go to Cincinnati for 2 days, there's a simple cello there that I keep in the studio. And it's just to keep my fingers in shape.
And it's something I suppose you have to do every day.
The older you get, the more diligent you have to be about staying in shape. It's very much like sports, like dance, like anything else. You don't use it, you lose it. Is that the expression? You see here on the wall, you can see my those pictures with Casals. Some of them, he looks like he's ready to kill me. These are the kind pictures. There are some that are really... And these are all American composers who wrote concertos for me. Joan Tower, Rand, and this is Miriam Gideon, and this is Lucas Force, whose piece I premiered. Virgil Thompson, whose concerto we found in the archives of the Yale Library, a concerto by Virgil Thompson.
Now, where was this that you were with the Casals?
These pictures were taken in Marlborough. And there's Aaron Copland conducting a concert that I played. And this is me and Bernstein when I was a teenager, just before I came here. One of the concerts we did was with, there was one concert about, you know, I told you that the topics are not necessarily musical. There was one concert dedicated to Shakespeare in music. There are thousands of works of, you know, some of them are orchestral, Midsummer Night's Dream and operas, Otello, and this is all Shakespeare. But there is also some intimate chamber music that is connected with him. People wrote music and to his texts. And we had with us Sigourney Weaver, the movie star, and she was very happy. At the time, she was working on a movie, something about aliens, or some bizarre... and she was so happy to come out of this and just to recite Shakespeare. She spent the whole evening... She's very tall. I'm not very tall. And she spent the whole evening on the stage barefoot. And I said to her, Sigourney, it's perfectly okay with me. And she did Ophelia, and she did all sorts of... she read a sonnet. Then we did a concert that was dedicated to Latin American dances. And we called it Tanglewood.
Tanglewood.
And the Tanglewood people were not very pleased. We were tampering with the holy cow. We were making fun of their name. So.
I mean, it was such a lucky thing. The last concert I came to was the trios, right. Trios. And I got a ticket at the last minute, but it just happened that I had the perfect unobstructed view of the keyboard, which was so nice.
This was Roman.
Yes.
Roman. Yeah. He was there last night, too.
Oh, he was.
Formidable artist. He won the Rubinstein first prize.
So how did you happen to meet him?
Oh, my goodness. I knew his teacher. And I have a good nose for what I consider great artistry. Not everybody is in agreement with that, but he is definitely one of us. He does not use, let me say it correctly, he does not play the instrument, he plays the music. In other words, he doesn't use the music to show his wonderful gifts, or doesn't, you know, it's the other way around. So it's, there's definitely a distinction. You can always tell when someone's actually using the music to show off a certain technical ability or prowess. And some are just dedicated artists. It's always difficult to find a balance between observing the requests or the wishes of the composer and injecting your own feelings or understanding of the piece. You have to, with a sense of responsibility, you cannot just take a piece and have your way with it just to use your own purposes.
Well, I certainly appreciate your agreeing to be interviewed.
Thank you. Thanks, Sam. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Your questions are very much to the point.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. My guest has been Yehuda Hanani. Here is his recording of the Bourée from Bach's Suite No. 3 for unaccompanied cello.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.